The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Martha Potter from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State Magazine. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting this podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. In this last Fifth Tuesday episode, we will dig deeper into the September issue of Our State Magazine and focus on some of the other featured stories that we don't often get to read to you. The first one is entitled Being Billy's. A group of volunteers repairs and cleans the gravestones of Greensboro's oldest public cemetery to honor those who came before them and beautify what they see as hallowed ground. And when Green Hill Cemetery opened in the heart of Greensboro in 1877, the city made room for 19,000 plots. All of them have been sold or used and are cared for by Green Hill Billies like Laura Allred. And we have a picture of Laura, and she's got a bucket and a brush, and she is scrubbing an old gravestone. Since forming the Green Hill Billies in 2023, David Kraft has brought in volunteers like Arlene McCain and Ann Roberts to help clean and repair gravestones once or twice a month. And they're pictured there. Actually, there's a toppled gravestone that they're repairing, and I'm going to set it to rights. When you say their name, remember to pause. The pause is about who they are and in whose footsteps they follow, even when the twinge in their shoulders and elbows make them question why they have a shovel, a scrub brush, or a pry bar in their hands. It's because of a guy named Bill. So they call themselves Green Hill, pause, Billies. The pause is them and their work. They clean and repair gravestones in Greensboro's Green Hill Cemetery, the city's oldest public burial ground. Near the entrance is a sign that bears their logo, a red bandana. Every few weeks, they tie them around their necks and gather. They're all volunteers of all ages, young and not so young. They scrub, brush, dig, and lift for a few hours, and sometimes fan out across the city and county to help churches understand how to beautify their own private graveyards and preserve a sacred space. David Kraft formed the Green Hill Billies 2 years ago. He lives three blocks from Green Hill, and whenever he walks through the cemetery, He saw too many gravestones in various stages of disrepair, including a 6-foot obelisk that could topple over with a gentle shove. I just couldn't sit there and let it fall, he says. So he began to research. He talked to experts, watched YouTube videos, and drove to Statesville for a gravestone restoration workshop presented by a company out of Connecticut. There he met another future amateur gravestone preservationist, Dr. Sherry Dry, an associate professor of information systems at NCA&T University in Greensboro. And their similar passion built the foundation for their nameless team of volunteers. The name would come, but first came what they saw as urgent, improving hallowed ground and appreciating the lives of those who came before them, people they didn't even know. Green Hill is like a statuary garden, shouldered, zipper-tight beside a one-way street, constantly buzzing with traffic, less than a mile north of downtown. But inside the cemetery, the busyness of the city fades into a whisper. The paths corkscrew through 51 acres, former farmland the city bought at least 150 years ago, and wind past heritage and history etched in marble and granite. Green Hill is the final resting place for the well-known and the little-known. They started a college, pastored a church, governed a city, led a school system, raised a family, immigrated to the United States from across the Atlantic, moved beyond slavery to build a life free from bondage. With its more than 300 kinds of trees and shrubs, Green Hill became what some called an accidental arboretum. When the cemetery opened in 1877, Greensboro was more country than city. and public burial grounds were gardens that exhibited respect and love for those in eternal rest. The stone used became the forever canvas to remember those gone. But today, that canvas is crumbling, and time is the eraser. Names and dates are barely legible on many gravestones, and trees and bushes have become an unintentional bully, engulfing monuments of memory and nudging them enough to topple them like dominoes. Decades of weather haven't helped either. The shifting earth has become a slow-moving quicksand, swallowing many of the tiny markers and thin slabs in the cemetery's 35 sections. So much to do. So Craft and Dry get to work. When you see all these statues that have fallen over, it's just not right, Craft says. These are people, part of Greensboro's history, and we have to honor them. There's this quote attributed to Ernest Hemingway where he said, "Everyone has two deaths," Dry says. "One is when you die and are buried. The second death is the last time someone says your name." And when I see the graves of children who have no offspring, who's going to care for their stones? That hits home for me. As the number of their volunteers grew, one of them proposed the idea of coming up with a name for our little ragtag group. She suggested a play on the word hillbillies. "What about the billies?" she said, as in green hillbillies. "Well," Craft responded, "that's my dad's first name." Bill Craft, a father of nine, was an amateur botanist with a drive that never waned. For decades, he ran his family's insurance company in Greensboro and beautified places in his hometown by planting trees and shrubs. When his kids were young, he would bring them along after hearing his wife say, "Take them out and go do something." Bill's kids would help some, but mainly he did everything solo. Bill became known as the Johnny Appleseed of Greensboro. He planted trees and shrubs he bought or dug up and transplanted to create green islands in the middle of a growing city. In Green Hill, evidence of his green thumb is everywhere. A redwood near the entrance, a Mexican weeping pine along a fence, a Kentucky coffee tree beside the walking path. For years, he gave tours of the cemetery and pointed out the family names he knew and the 400 trees he planted. In January 2000, when a reporter asked him about his Johnny's Appleseed habits in Green Hill, Bill said, "This way I can come over here and enjoy the plants, and everyone else can too." Bill died in December 2010 at age 81, yet the tours he started years ago continue. Ann Stringfield, who lives a block from Green Hill, offers tours at least 8 times a year. She joined one of Bill's tours in the mid-1990s, and after going 2 more times, she told Bill she'd like to help. "All right, you're giving the next tour," he responded. She did, and more. "It helped me feel like living part of the city," she says, "and it helps bring the living back in." In 2009, she started the volunteer group Friends of Green Hill Cemetery with David Craft to do things like recruit volunteers to cut back overgrowth and help create a fund to buy benches, bronze plaques, and labels for the many trees. Stringfield called her tours "The Plants and the Planted," and from her research, she's gleaned more than a few lessons about Greensboro and about life. Take her favorite epitaph: "Here endeth the first lesson. We're all only here for a short time, and every one of these graves represents someone whose family has experienced loss," said Stringfield, a retired research librarian. "Grief is natural, and this helps me recognize this is everyone's experience, so we might as well get on with the now and enjoy it." Laura Allred, one of the Green Hill Billies, can attest to that. When she was a child, Allred came to Green Hill with her family to visit the graves of her father's relatives. They'd lay a red geranium or a chrysanthemum atop the grave of her paternal grandmother, and her Aunt Margie or her parents would say, "She would have loved you so much." Decades later, when Allred visited her dad's only sister in Florida, Aunt Margie pulled from a file cabinet the deed for the last spot in the family's plot at Green Hill and handed it to Allred. "There's one space left," she said. "It's yours." Whenever she volunteers, Allred tidies her family's 2 plots and sets a red geranium or some other flower atop her grandmother's grave to remember her. Then she stands near the very spot where she and her husband Hugh will have their ashes interred. She prays. I feel that they're looking down from heaven and smiling at me and loving me from afar. And that gives me a feeling of peace, she says. It reminds me that no matter what our troubles here on earth are, we are still alive and life is still worth living. That's what David Kraft has helped create. Like his dad, he enjoys working with his hands. He digs in the dirt and beautifies where he feels rooted. And Green Hill makes him feel rooted. He's surrounded by friends in red bandanas who understand the passion of that guy named Bill. The Green Hill Cemetery is located on Wharton Street in Greensboro, and there's a website, friendsofgreenhillcemetery.org, friendsofgreenhillcemetery.org. All right, next up is The Best of Both Worlds. Born in the U.S. and raised in Guatemala, a food historian and cookbook author found her calling in North Carolina, where Southern and Latino dishes happily share a table. And we have a picture of the subject. Sandra Gutierrez discovered her love of cooking as a child growing up in Guatemala, where she spent time in her grandmother's kitchen. My food was established in my heart, she says. And it shows a picture of her at a cutting board chopping vegetables for the dish. If you go to Sandra Gutierrez's brick house in a Cary suburb surrounding a golf course, you'll definitely get fed. At lunch on a summer day, she's made a thick orange gazpacho from tomatoes and peppers grown in the garden that completely fills her backyard. There's pimento cheese, one of her southern favorites, to spread on a fluffy focaccia made with her 12-year-old sourdough starter. Then she pours a glass of lightly sweetened chocolate iced tea. Yes, chocolate. Brewed with both tea and the husks of roasted cocoa beans she brings back from visits to Latin America, giving the beverage a smoky undertone of dark chocolate. While it's usually served hot in South America, she pours it over ice as a nod to her Southern/Latin American life. It breaks the stereotype of Southern iced tea and brings it together, she says. And that's Gutierrez herself, born in Philadelphia, raised in her parents' native Guatemala, and steeped in a Southern life she and her husband Louis have lived in North Carolina for 30 years. Finding her place at the intersection of these worlds has shaped her career and guided her through the ups and downs of an extraordinary life. I feel like a bona fide Southerner, she says in a Spanish-tinged lilt that she jokes is her version of a Philly accent. So are my daughters and so are my granddaughters. The one thing we want as human beings is to belong. That was the hardest thing, to belong. Gutierrez, age 60, can't cook tortillas on her favorite comal, the round griddle that's usually the center of a Mesoamerican kitchen. It's in the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History, not far from the recreation of Julia Child's kitchen, along with Gutierrez's biscuit cutters, jello mold, and several pieces of Guatemalan ceramics. Having her kitchen tools in that most American institution is fitting. Smithsonian research associate Ashley Rose Young says she has that joie de vivre, like the Latina Julia Child. Pretty impressive considering that Gutierrez's food writing career started by accident. Raised in Guatemala from the age of 5, she and Luis were sweethearts in high school before he went off to college in Michigan, then to Canada to start a career in business, and she went to Smith College to major in English. Her parents were both university faculty members who believed in education. Her father always taught her that knowing people with a variety of views was the best way to learn, so I became a researcher. What she really loved, though, was cooking. Her grandmother was a twice-widowed socialite in Guatemala who was famous for entertaining. People from Che Guevara to Julio Iglesias came to her house. Gutierrez was a shy child, so after greeting the guests as her grandmother required, she'd sneak to the kitchen where the servants would put her to work, shaping empanadas, making tortillas and sauces, and cleaning beans. After getting married, the Gutierrezes came to Duke University in 1985 while Luis got his MBA. They returned to Toronto, but they had fallen in love with North Carolina, so they came back in 1994, this time with their two young daughters, Alessandra and Nicole. North Carolina won our hearts, Gutierrez says. The people, the weather, the university world, we've always craved to be around people who like to learn in every walk of life. Luis was starting his own business, and at the time, it was a little cheaper to live in Cary than Durham. So they searched until they found a house with a kitchen big enough for Gutierrez's long wooden table. One day in 1996, Luis came home with a copy of the Cary News. The paper was looking for an editor to write a column on Southern food, and he suggested that Gutierrez submit something. So she dashed off a piece on olive oil. The next night, she got a call from the paper. She had the job. Luis had 48 hours to teach her how to use Microsoft Word. I was really green, she says. I didn't know anything. The editor of the Cary News later told Gutierrez she'd gotten a call from a woman who was incensed that the paper had hired a Mexican to write a Southern food column. The editor told the caller, give her a chance. The South is growing. We need a wider net. Gutierrez's skills as a researcher were her salvation. She knew almost nothing about Southern cooking, so she turned to the paper's readers, getting people to teach her how to make biscuits, going to church suppers and potlucks, and judging food contests. I was so open to comments from readers, she said. Cooks, we're gregarious people. She also started to notice something. Southern and Latin American foods were overlapping. Grits and masa, the corn flour used in tortilla, are almost the same. Pork turns up in every form imaginable. And Latino ingredients were creeping into Southern recipes. Smoky chipotle peppers and barbecue sauce. Cilantro in corn and tomato salads. Jalapenos in hush puppies. At a party, she noticed that barbecue was goat, not hog. And the potato salad was next to a platter of tostones, or fried green plantains. I realized I was seeing something, she says now. I named it New Southern Latino. It's not that I invented it. I was just the right person to see the convergence. I think my Smith College education came out. At the time, Chapel Hill was filled with food writing luminaries like Nancy McDermott and the late Jean Anderson. They encouraged her to write a proposal for a book on what she was seeing. Elaine Meisner, the now-retired editor at UNC Press, who handled both food books and Latin American studies, saw the proposal and told Gutierrez, I want a whole book on this. This isn't a fad. This is a movement. But I'm not a Southerner, Gutierrez recalled, protesting. She said, sure you are. I felt adopted. Without losing my Guatemalan heritage, I had become a Southerner. The New Southern Latino Table was published in 2011, and Gutierrez won the M.F.K. Fisher Award for Excellence in Culinary Writing from Les Dames d'Escoffier International. This wasn't chef-driven, she says, about the book's appeal. This was from cooks. A Southerner and a Latino at the table will see a dish, and they'll both recognize it. After 8 years, Gutierrez wrapped up her job at the Cary News. She had a thriving career as a cooking teacher and an author who eventually wrote two more books for UNC Press, Latin American Street Food and Beans and Field Peas for the Savor the South series. Right after leaving the paper, she was fixing dinner one night when her phone rang and a woman asked, is this Sandra Gutierrez? The caller wouldn't give her name, but she admitted she was the one who had complained about the paper getting a Mexican getting the food editor's job. I'm really going to miss your columns, the woman said. By 2020, the world shut down during the COVID pandemic. Gutierrez had hit her stride. Her daughters were grown and established. Alessandra is a dentist in Charlotte, and Nicole is an attorney living with her husband 5 minutes from the family home. Gutierrez was ready to tackle her biggest project yet, an encyclopedic cookbook on the home cooking of all 21 countries of Latin America. She had always been passionate about the need to understand that not all Latino food is the same, and it definitely isn't all a Mexican. Latinismo was the book I always intended to write, she said. In 2007, she'd pitched the idea to her agent at the time, Lisa Ickes, who told her to wait. People aren't ready for a comprehensive tome like that yet. Now, Gutierrez was in the Smithsonian Institution, part of the exhibit Food Transforming the American Table. She was known all over the food writing world. It was time, and in the midst of pandemic lockdowns, she had the time. First, she and Luis put in a sprawling garden, 8 raised beds, a greenhouse, 60 kinds of tomatoes, eggplants, beans, pimentos, poblanos, tomatillas, pear trees, apple trees. With a massive recipe project ahead of her, she needed the ingredients. By 2021, she'd finished the manuscript with her current agent, Sally Ekus, and Lisa's daughter sold to Fred A. Knopf, the same publisher that handled Julia's Child's Mastering the Art of French Cooking. Gutierrez scheduled a 2-week photo shoot in her kitchen using a dozen volunteers to cook for hundreds of pictures. When it was all finished, she noticed a pain in her neck. She went for an x-ray and was told she had a tumor in her lung. A biopsy showed stage 4 lung cancer. Gutierrez, who is a devout Catholic and a non-smoker, remembers standing in a garden and saying, "Really, God? I'm not even going to see one season?" A second doctor questioned the diagnosis, though, and sent her biopsy for a long-term study. It wasn't lung cancer. It was a rare condition that produces tumor-like growths that aren't malignant. But an MRI showed something else, a broken neck. To this day, she doesn't know how it happened. The doctor called her in and said, "Sit down and don't even pick up a pencil." She was sent to Duke Medical Center for immediate surgery. Before she was wheeled in, Luis was advised to say goodbye. When she woke up, she couldn't feel anything from the neck down. The doctor told her, "We saved your life, but you may never swallow again." Gutierrez spent 12 weeks in intensive care, unable to move, but slowly movement and feeling crept back. She had to relearn how to walk on a treadmill with a harness holding her up. In physical therapy, she learned to hold her newborn granddaughter. And in a rehabilitation center, she relearned motor skills by cooking a Cuban meal for 12. She kept herself going through her faith and her determination to finish Latinismo. "I could cut, I could chop, I could stand. God had another plan," she says. "I find blessings in every day, no matter how mundane. I learned to walk at the same time as my granddaughter." And in 2023, Latinismo came out to wide acclaim and coverage in the New York Times. Today, she has 3 granddaughters. She and Luis have turned their den into a daycare where they take care of the kids. The girls are learning their colors through her crop of tomatoes, and one is already obsessed with grits. In the backyard, she's cut back on the types of tomatoes from 60 to 18, and she makes her way around easily with no trace of a limp. She's gotten to see a lot more seasons of growth after all. "I still don't know why I'm here," she says. "I'm still waiting to find out." The next article is entitled "Winged Rainbows. On our coast, painted buntings flash their colors, sing for love, and remind us to stay hopeful." The French call painted buntings, a bird the size of a house finch flitting through the shrubs on our southernmost shores, nonpareil, or without equal. They're right. Each adult male bunting carries a rainbow splattered across his body, red underneath with a lime green back, bluish purplish head, red eye ring. They seem too dressed up for North Carolina's coastal scrubland, bearing their Sunday best to a pig picking. "They're the most colorful bird in the United States," says Brian O'Shea, assistant curator and collection manager of ornithology at the North Carolina Museum of Natural Sciences. "The texture of their feathers impresses me. The brighter bird colors have feathers with a glossy, iridescent texture, and painted buntings are covered in that. 2 painted bunting populations live in the U.S., and a sliver of southeastern North Carolina makes up the upper tip of the eastern group. Though they're here, it's rare to see one. The females and young males are as green as the shrubs where they hide, and their movements easy to mistake for a marsh breeze or a slight shiver of a laurel oak bough. And they rarely fly more than a couple of miles inland. Rare, but not impossible for those who take the time to look and hope. Beginning in April, the painted buntings here fly in from Florida, and probably further south," O'Shea says. "This population runs from northeast Florida up the Atlantic coast to as far north as Morehead City. Though they only occasionally vacation in the Outer Banks, they love the maritime forests and open salt marshes of Fort Fisher, Hammocks Beach, and Bald Head Island. Unlike the females and their younger brethren, older males can't blend in. Like cardinals, those bastions of aerial fashion, male buntings are showboats for love. The more colorful the feathers, the more desirable they are to the females. Beacons in the brush, it seems possible that these winged rainbows haven't been wiped off the map. Pinioned and hawk talons, cat claws, or the human need to grab and cage things of beauty. For painted buntings, the benefit of beauty are worth the risk of annihilation. Males look like females until they're 2 years old, O'Shea says. Young green males are perfectly capable of mating. While they sing and dance just as older males do, the females prefer older men. Females like the colors. The males will keep dressing up. Beneath their rainbow plumage, painted buntings are just small birds. They do what plenty of other small birds do, eat seeds, build little cup nests in bushes or trees, lay speckled eggs, migrate. They sing to each other and hop around on branches. They fly, pushing their bodies bravely into the air with their tiny muscles and hollow bones. Every now and then, a wanderer ventures farther into the state. For the last 3 years, a male painted bunting has shown up at Dick's Park in Raleigh, O'Shea says. He flies in around April and he sings, but he never finds a mate. He keeps coming back, though. Imagine taking years to get dressed up and then showing up at the venue only to find there's no party after all. And then to keep showing up, to keep singing even though there are no ears to hear you. There's valor in those feathers, and there's hope, too. This could be the year. He could perch on the stem of a sunflower leaf without bending it. He could, blue head back, red chest ruffled in the breeze against the open sky, open his beak and sing, his black eyes wide open to the world around him. Wait, he could sing again. His call joining the matter-of-fact treble of robins and the pretty girl of cardinals in that morning chorus. This could be the year that, waiting in the tall grass beyond, she hears him. She could sing back to him. There's no telling what could happen in our world. With just a few seconds left, I'm going to go to the Book Smarts quiz. And we already covered one story earlier. So question number two. The O. Henry Hotel in Greensboro takes its name from the pseudonym of which short story writer who was born in the Gate City in 1862. Is it Henry Porter, Oliver Porter, or William Sidney Porter? If you guessed C, William Sidney Porter, you would be correct. Number three. Prize-winning poet, composer, and civil rights activist Maya Angelou lived in Winston-Salem. She was also a humanities professor at which university from 1982 until she died in 2014? Was it A, UNC Greensboro, B, Wake Forest, or C, NC State? If you said Wake Forest, you win the cardboard cookie. And there, that sound means we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Martha Potter, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine is underwritten by Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired and is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. For questions and comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.